Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 97.9 The Wren. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being here with us again this week. Sunday morning wake-up call, as we talk about real estate, focus on the local Central Virginia real estate. Our guest today, Matt Hodges, Presidential Bank Mortgage, and Jim Duncan, a realtor with Nest Realty. Gentlemen, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Rick.
Morning,
good
Rick.
Morning.
So just dive straight into it. Who wants to talk about projecting the 2022 market? Jim, you're the realtor. Let's hear it from your side of things first.
Be an interesting market, as I said, for the last many years of my career. This one's interesting in different ways. It's a really challenging market for buyers right now. Sellers are in a great position if they can find somewhere to go to. A lot of local sellers are moving out of the area and taking advantage of the market. But from a buyer's perspective, it's a really challenging market. I think 22 is going to continue to be so for a little bit. To give you some quick context, Rick, in January, 102 resale homes were listed in Charlottesville and Albemarle, so excluding new construction. 69 of those went under contract in January, and 90 are under contract or sold as of today. The average days on market was 4, and the median was 4. That's a hard market for buyers who are in a position of making super fast decisions about how they're going to spend, in many cases, the rest of their lives. We don't have enough inventory in the market. We've been saying that for years. We still don't. And we have a lot of buyers who love living in the Central Virginia area, and they continue to buy homes here, and the prices are continuing to accelerate. So it's going to be an interesting 22. And sellers, I think that they're in a great spot. If they have somewhere to go on the other side.
And Matt Hodges, from the mortgage side of things, is there a different viewpoint?
Well, I've got very similar thoughts, but I'll expand a little bit on what I see in my market. I probably have right now 2 to 3 times as many buyers as I would traditionally have this time of year. In the beginning of what we call the spring market. And many of those are holdovers from last year, sometimes even from 2 years ago. So throughout this whole COVID phase, buyers have been out there trying to find their house, and they haven't been able to. They're somewhat discouraged. Some are, you know, not going to end up buying, but I do regular check-ins with them, and they're still active. So the demand is certainly there, but we're losing a little bit of the supply. And then on that supply side, many of my buyers have a house to sell, but they're frankly afraid to list the house for sale because they believe it's going to sell so quickly and they won't be able to find their next home. So they're using mechanics to get into the next house, own two houses at the same time, and that's perpetuating part of the issue with the supply.
Yeah, to add a little bit of color to that also from my perspective. I'm working with quite a few buyers right now. And I think last weekend I was out with some buyers with whom we've been working together for about a year. And last weekend was the first time in a year that we showed 3 houses in a weekend, where every other time I've seen them, we'd looked at one and say goodbye. So I mean, I think that seeing 2 or 3 in a weekend is really good. I was with another set of buyers the other day, and we were talking about how more inventory is starting to come to the market. And I said, you know, I've seen y'all twice in 10 days, whereas previously it was once every 3, 4, or 5 months. And they're looking in the city of Charlottesville as were the other ones. So it's a challenging environment for buyers right now. But I think that, you know, as we near spring, I think that we're going to see, I won't say a lot more, but we're certainly going to see more homes coming in the market for buyers to be able to choose from. And I think that's going to be a good and healthy thing overall from the market perspective. But I don't see the multiple offer scenario diminishing that much unless interest rates really start to go higher than they are now.
Sunday morning wake-up call. Again, we are talking about the real estate market with a focus on the local real estate. Jim Duncan, Nest Realty, and Matt Hodges from Presidential Bank Mortgage are here with us. Matt, you made mention of sellers afraid to put their house on the market because it was going to sell so quickly that they might not be ready to actually sell it because they didn't have a place to go to yet. Does this sort of inability / disinterest to own two homes lead to more commercial buyers?
Commercial meaning cash offers, institutional buyers for investment property? Is that what you're...
Whether it's cash, you'd have to explain that part to me. But for somebody who's going to buy it and then rent it or do something else to it, flip it and then sell it again sort of thing.
That is a huge issue, and that's not an issue necessarily that's specific to our area. It's a nationwide problem where asset managers are looking at real estate as an attractive source of return, and then just even individuals here in Charlottesville area who are looking for rental properties because they kick off good income flow versus the cost of the house. Now, if we look at the offers and some of the things that we hear about offers and acceptances, there's often a cash buyer who wins a bid because it's cash. And if you come from the seller's perspective, you don't have any contingencies where a homeowner that's coming forward has an appraisal, they want to do a home inspection, they've got financing that they need to get cleared. And all those things are contingencies to selling the house. A cash buyer at or even below the sales price that a homeowner would come forward with is more attractive because there's no contingencies. The deal is done. They've shown that they have the money to buy it outright, even if they end up financing it. And what we understand is that roughly half of those cash buyers end up getting financing anyway.
Yeah, so, hey, Rick, let me add one thing to that. I think that one of the things that I try to hammer home to my clients, buyers or sellers, is that is what Matt said, is that, yes, it's a cash offer, but you have to be mindful of the fact that just because they have the funds doesn't mean that they're going to allocate those funds to the house. A lot of them are going to get loans, about half of them on average. I mean, it's hard from a buyer to compete against that. I'm going to completely fabricate numbers right here, but if there's a house for $500 and a person with a loan offers $560, they're mindful of all the stuff that Matt's talking about. But somebody with cash could come in and pay and offer $580 or even $550 or $540, and the seller would look at the offers and say, well, I like I like this loan, this package, but cash gives me a much fuzzier feeling. I think that's something that we need to be mindful of. But also from a seller's perspective, protect the fact that it's cash, because even if the buyer goes to get a loan, make sure that cash transaction is not going to be sideswiped by somebody getting a loan and delaying closing, because a lot of stuff happens after for that seller that they're counting on happening based on that timeline. So it's just, again, it's a interesting and fascinating time to see what's happening in our market.
Jim Duncan, you mentioned that you believe the spring would bring a little more inventory and the housing market to our Central Virginia area. What makes you say that? And is it going to be anything significant? Let me rephrase that. Is it going to be anything to take us back to relief on the stress that's currently on the buyers? Or is it just going to be, oh, instead of seeing one house on the weekend, maybe you can see five?
I think it's going to be the latter. I mean, I think that we're not going to see, and frankly, we don't want to see, you know, so many homes come on the market that the buyers, either the buyer has 15 or 20 or 30 to choose from on the weekend, because that means that the market's going to be flooded and it's going to, you know, make prices, you know, stagnate and decline, most likely. And that would mean something catastrophic had happened to cause inventory to go that high so fast. But I think that, candidly, part of it is hope. Because, you know, my buyers are exhausted, and I think that, you know, we're ready for more stuff to come on. But also we're starting to see more stuff coming on the market. Just every single day we're seeing more coming soon and more active listings that are hitting the market that, you know, that my buyer clients are interested in. So I think that's certainly a good thing. We're not going to see a massive increase, but seasonally our market, you know, every, you know, February, March, April, things pick up, more markets, more houses come on the market, and it's a good thing. But if something substantive, I don't think we're going to see it.
Yeah, Rick, just anecdotally with my business, I'm seeing contracts earlier. January, I received one just recently that was a bit unexpected. So I'm seeing that there's new inventory coming on, and I'm seeing the social media posts that firms are putting on, not necessarily an individual realtor, but the firm's listings. And I'm seeing some momentum there. I'm seeing listings that I know my clients are going to go out and see. So I'm hopeful as well, but all it is anecdotal, data at this point.
I mean, Rick, I've written this real estate blog for, I think, 17 years now. And I'm looking at a post from August 2011. About inventory finally dropping, so I think it's something that in 2012 low housing inventory stinks in Charlotte and Albemarle. So I think it's something that we've been in this area of low inventory for a long time, and the only solution to that is going to be building more housing, and it's very difficult to build new homes, not just in Charlotte or Albemarle, but anywhere, at a place where it's going to be affordable, depending on their various definitions of affordable. It's going to be affordable for many buyers. It's not a great, it's not, there's no good or easy answer to solving the housing crisis that we're faced with.
By the way, if you want to read Jim Duncan's blog and some of the articles there, you can go to realcentralva.com. Matt, I believe you're the one who mentioned the possibility of rising interest rates. If we have such short buying dates, I don't know that that's a proper phrase, but if something goes on the market and within 4 days it's coming off the market through sale, what is expected to be a rising interest rate that actually brings trepidation to the buyers?
Yeah, it's an excellent question, and I think we're going to find out some of those answers. In the last 2 years, we had artificially low interest rates that was Fed-driven, right? The Federal Reserve, through their policies, decided that they were going to be a huge buyer of mortgage-backed securities. And that's just a fancy way of saying bundle a whole bunch of loans together and sell it on the open market. Well, if that open market is Wall Street and it is some, massive company that wants to own these mortgage-backed securities, and the Fed comes in and is even a bigger player, it pushes down the interest rates. Well, the Fed's escaping that market by March. They're also increasing the short-term lending rates, so not the mortgage side, but on the home equity line of credit, credit cards, car loans, things like that. And they're also going to let roll off of their balance sheet older mortgage-backed securities. And when I say roll off, that means that a loan gets paid off because the house sells. A loan gets paid off because they refinance to another lower rate. Or the loan just hits maturity and there's no more mortgage on that house. In the past, the Fed would buy a like security to replace the one that rolled off of their balance sheet. They're not doing that anymore. They're looking to treasuries. All of these things have a negative effect on interest rates. The interest rates have already pushed up since mid-December when they were in the low threes, and now they're four on or on either side of four. My clients tend to be risk averse and conservative when they buy. They're not pushing the debt to income ratios that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac would allow. So they've got some room to absorb higher interest rates, but at some point it's going to feel pretty uncomfortable to have a rate that is much higher than you could have gotten 2 years ago. You also have an issue with people who refinanced and now aren't going to think so much about selling their house because they've got a great rate in the house that they're in, and they might renovate it instead of moving.
Jim, I was going to ask, the term velocity that I've run across when looking into current market issues, what does velocity mean in the real estate world?
How fast the house comes on the market and goes on the contract. And it's, you know, our market is a fast moving market. I mean, a lot of times a house will come on the market on Thursday or Friday, and it's under contract within 24, 48 hours, which is an extraordinarily fast time, again, to decide whether you're going to move your family to a place to be for 7, 10, 15 years. But I think that what Matt was talking about earlier, that there's so many buyers who are holdovers from 21, 20, 19, that they've been targeting one or two neighborhoods. And so when that one comes on that fits, those buyers are going to move extremely fast. Something that, you know, just how fast the house moves. And it's one that Matt and I have talked before about, just the fact that we're talking about velocity with, you know, in the housing market is hard because it's not a commodity. You know, housing is not a commodity. It's a place where people make lives and spend, you know, the bulk of their lives. So it's, it's a hard thing, but the short answer is it's how fast the house moves.
Do you believe that raising the interest rate 0.5% or 0.5% is going to reduce velocity a noticeable amount?
I think so. I mean, I think that it's important to look at it in the context of, you know, I always tell people, my wife and I bought our first house, you know, 20-some years ago. Our rate was 8 1/8, and we were very, very happy. When my mom was selling real estate in the early 80s, it was 18%. So historically, 4 and 5 and 6 are still really low. But I think that we've been in this, you know, 2.5 to 3.5 interest rate environment for, what, Matt, 10, 12 years?
That's a very long time.
Yeah, so a long time. So today's buyers don't even, you know, they don't have that historical knowledge because they're looking at what it is right now. You know, I showed a house the other day that was, you know, with like a 15-year-old house, 10-year-old house, and my buyer client said, huh, I couldn't even vote when this house was built. So, you know, so the perspective is fairly narrow. But I think that two or three years ago, rates spiked about a point. Because if I recall, Matt, you and I talked then, the rates spiked in part because the volume was so high of mortgages that they had to slow it down. And that caused things to really slow down for about a month or two. So I think that the short answer is, yeah, I think that as rates rise, I think we're going to see things slow down a little bit.
Sunday morning wake-up call here. We're talking with Jim Duncan from Nest Realty and Matt Hodges from Presidential Bank Mortgage to get insight and learn some tips coming up on the real estate market. Hang tight, everyone. We'll be right back. And thank you, everybody, for being here with us today. So, gentlemen, Matt, you mentioned earlier in the program about having some buyers still with you who had been around since last year and even some from 2 years ago. So I'll let you start, and then I want Jim to step in. Have you had buyers who started out looking and then sort of faded away because they became disinterested or disheartened?
Oh, you know, absolutely. The buyers that are out there tend to want to find their next property within a defined period of time. Sometimes it's tied to when a lease ends, for example. That's not as big a deal today, but it's that constant emotional challenge where you're going out there and thinking, wow, this would be perfect for myself, for us as a couple, for us as a family, whatever the unit is. And it doesn't happen, and there's discouraged buyer. And then it happens again 2 weeks later, and then they put it off for a while. What I've tried to do, and what most good realtors are doing as well, is keeping the client engaged. It doesn't mean pushing them towards a house that isn't right for them, but understanding, empathizing with them throughout the process. So I just had touch points with all of my clients to check in with them, to see how they're doing, to see where their mind is, to see what type of time frame that they're working under. I've been doing this for 23 years. Love what I do. And a client may not be a client next week. They might be a client next month, next year. And that's perfectly fine. Let's just make sure that their needs are met and that they don't get so discouraged about the marketplace that they divorce themselves completely from finding their next home.
And Jim, how about on your end? Because Matt makes mention about somebody wanting to, or one scenario is a couple possibly wanting to find a home before the lease ends. And that maybe not being an issue now if the velocity is rather high and homes selling within 4 days on the market. But my image in my head is, well, gosh, aren't you taking a house that has things you don't want because you need a house because your lease is about to end or you extend your lease? So what's the what you're seeing on your end versus Matt's version?
I mean, very similar. I mean, I had one buyer years ago I think of frequently at this time of year. You know, he would come out of the woodwork every year. His lease would come up for renewal in March or April. And we'd talk in January, February. We'd look. We wouldn't find anything. And he'd renew his lease. It took, I think, 3 or 4 years to find the right place. And he's happy there. But I think it's you know, one of the things that we've seen in the pandemic is that there's been a flattening of the market, if you will, where it's still very seasonal. But I talked to a lot of realtors in November, December were some of the busiest November, Decembers we've ever seen. There's people who just, they had to buy something. But I think it's also something that I've said to my buyers for years that every buyer makes compromises, but it takes time to figure out what those compromises are that you're willing to accept. I don't want anybody, ideal in a perfect world, to call me up in February and say, I need to buy a house by April 1st because my job's starting. That's not a good scenario. The ideal is that someone will move here, rent for 6 or 9 months, and use that time to find the right place. Because the right house, there's a much greater chance of the right house coming in the market in 6 or 12 months than in 6 or 15 days. So I think it's something that it requires a deliberate and diligent practice to find the right place. But yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of buyers out there who are frustrated because they've been looking for 3, 6, 9, 20 months for the right place. And prices have been increasing every month. Prices go up. So it gets harder and harder for some people to buy. But it's, the market is doing what the market's doing. So I think that what I advise my buyers is, and it's hard for everybody, frankly, is to be as patient as they possibly can be, make the best offer you feel comfortable winning or losing on that house. And if it works, awesome. And if it doesn't work, you know, that wasn't the right house. And sometimes you want to, you know, you make the offer, you're comfortable winning or losing. And if you lose, you move on to the next one when the next one comes.
A quick follow-up to that, and I realize that that real estate sales and purchases are the specialty for both of you, but Albemarle County real estate assessments came out recently, correct?
Yep.
So I'm curious what effect that would have on sales and purchases and rentals.
I don't know. You know, I think it's hard, right? I mean, it's for me, I think the assessments, you know, one, they are by code, they're supposed to be 100% of market value. But I think from a rental perspective, you know, if the property owner's mortgage goes up because the taxes go up, there's a reasonable expectation that the rent will go up as well. So again, I think that, you know, as things get more expensive, they're going to pass it on to the people who are paying the rent.
Does that drive more people who've been renting out to seeking to buy instead? And I'm not talking about students or grad students.
Does higher rent drive them to buy?
I think so.
I mean, I think that for those who have the life stability to know they're going to be somewhere for 4 to 7 years, I think that buying a house could be the right decision for them. At least they should at least have the conversation with a good realtor and with a, you know, a great lender like Matt to figure out whether that scenario would work for them. But yeah, I mean, rents are, you know, I looked at one rental for a client the other day who's going to rent and then is going to buy. And you know, I was looking on Zillow at the rent, and it went up like 43% in 3 years, which is stifling. So yeah, I mean, I think that assessments are really going to affect people on all areas.
I'm seeing quite a few renters who are buying their own property. One of my clients went under contract, and she was paying, let's say, roughly $1,000 in rent, and she's going to be paying $1,250 in a mortgage, and that's perfectly comfortable for her, and she'll have equity, and she'll have building equity over time. She's comfortable in that property, and the seller was ready to cash out at that point. I'm seeing that where there's a direct contract between the two, and sometimes it never even hits the MLS marketplace.
Interesting.
Which, frankly, is a great solution for the landlord, because they get to sell the property to somebody that they know is good, is from a buying perspective, and the landlord does not have to make needed repairs, and the tenant knows all the things that need to be fixed, and they're good with it. So I mean, I've represented buyers many times in that scenario. It can be a win-win for everybody.
Jim Duncan, a realtor at Nest Realty, and Matt Hodges with Presidential Bank Mortgage here with us today as we talk about the real estate market. So, Jim, I'm going to start with you here on this question. For a buyer in any market, but especially in today's market with these rapid purchases, how does somebody stay unemotional in making this decision that both of you have already identified as being challenging to do on a quick basis for something, a home that these folks will probably live in for 8 to 15 years or longer?
You know, there's no easy answer or method to it. I mean, it's, you know, my role is to be the unemotional detached advisor and counselor in that instance, and to, you know, to empathize and be mindful, but not share the emotions. It is hard. I mean, I think it's hard whether you're a buyer or a seller. I mean, sellers, and a lot of sellers are having multiple offers, and, you know, they, if you've got 8, 10, 12 offers, that can be an emotional process because you want to sell the house to 10 people, you know, and then you know that you're disappointing 9. And if you're a buyer, I think that, you know, it's a very difficult situation because this is the place where you want your, you know, if you have kids, it's where you want your kids to go to school. And this is where, if you don't have kids, it's where you want to walk downtown or farm or whatever, you know, live your life. And I try to help people, you know, as much as possible, detach. You know, I tend to say just, you know, deliberately, flippantly, you know, it's just a bunch of sticks and bricks. You know, we'll find another one. You know, it fits all the needs, but, you know, and then once you get it under contract, then we can sort of let some of the emotions in. But it's also there, as Matt well knows, things happen between contract and closing that I try to stay as unemotional as possible and reflect that upon my clients until closing. Because I've seen any number of things can happen that can throw something sideways. But yeah, it's an inherently emotional and disruptive process on many, many levels.
Matt?
Yeah, so I tried at this point to do an intake interview, if you will, like via Zoom, so I can put a face to a name, to a voice. And I try to find out what their wants and needs are and to empathize and to hear the emotion at that point. And then I very much try to keep the project of them buying their home on a track that does not involve emotion. I don't want them overpaying for a house. I don't want them to get overly in love with a property that they may or may not win under contract. I will put together a worksheet of where the top of the range is of what they've told me, either payment on a monthly basis or purchase price, knowing that anything below that is going to be comfortable for them. And we talk about that. I say, I'm not giving you this number so that you go to this point. I give you this number so that everything below it's going to feel comfortable, and try to do it in a very unemotional way. I do recite back what they've talked to me about, what their goals are, so that I can get those things accurate and try to remove some of the emotion. We're talking numbers here. So I agree with Jim. I think that the less emotion we can put into the process, the better our clients are served.
Jim, we were talking about Matt experiencing buyers sort of coming and going by over this 2-year time period, some of them sticking around, some of them stepping away and then coming back. What about buyer agents? Because I would think that it's just as difficult to, in this market of looking to find something, showing properties, being one of, I think you said, 10 offers and with 9 who are being turned away. What is that like? If you don't know, then you must know a colleague.
No, I mean, I think that any active agent in this market is writing offers that are not going to win. And it's, you know, it's exhausting to write 4, 5, 6, 7 offers for buyers that don't win. But that's what we do. I mean, I think it's just, you know, yes, it's exhausting, but to the point, you know, previous point about not being emotional, my emotion or exhaustion is irrelevant. You know, each time I need to, you know, do the absolute best for my client and present the best possible offer to the seller. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, there's no way to spin in a great way. But the best way I look at it is every offer that I write to my buyers that doesn't get accepted, they are better at writing offers, and so they take what the, you know, the feedback. I try to get feedback from every agent whenever I write an offer that doesn't get accepted. You know, whether it was price, was it cash, was it, you know, did the other buyer waive home inspection, you know, whatever. You know, I try to talk to the agents to see how I can strengthen the offer for this buyer and for the next one. But yeah, I mean, there are, I haven't looked at the numbers locally in a little while, but I saw a headline the other day that said there are more listings, or there are more realtors than there are listings in the country. So you have a lot of agents who are new, who don't have experience. writing offers. And so that's going to certainly increase the number of people writing offers right now.
Well, let me ask you real quick, because we have a break coming up in 60 seconds. Does this exhaustion, I would have thought that the exhaustion would weed out some of the part-time agents, but you said that there are a lot of real estate agents. Does this exhaustion not weed out agents?
I don't know. I mean, I think it should, because you need to be doing a certain number of transactions a year to be competent. But I think that if you are doing it as a hobby and you need to one or two transactions a year to pay your side expenses, your fun expenses, then it doesn't matter if you're writing off or not winning, because it's not a living. It's not a practice. It's a hobby that you do on the side of your real job. So, I don't know. I think it depends on what the buyer agent's motivation is.
Sunday morning wake up call here. Our guests today, Matt Hodges, Jim Duncan. You can also go to Jim's blog at realcentralva.com for more information on our topic of the day, which is real estate, a little focus on local real estate in Central Virginia. Hang tight, everybody. We'll be back for another 20 minutes. Be right back. All right, everybody. Thank you once again. Keeping up your interest on local real estate with Jim Duncan and Matt Hodges. Gentlemen, there was something I didn't know anything about until the both of you mentioned this as we were preparing for today's show. Buyers writing love letters to the home sellers. I'd like to get both perspectives. And so I'm going to start with Jim.
So buyer love letters, I think most buyers who have been active in the market for the last 2 to 4 years are familiar with the concept of writing a letter to the seller, identifying why you are the best buyer for their home. Whether it's, you saw that they went to UVA and you went to UVA A school also, they should sell you their house because of that, or if they have two kids and you have two kids, or whatever those commonalities are that you want to convey as the buyer. I think last year the National Association of Realtors put out some guidance saying don't do these, because it opens a door, pretty broad door, to potential for fair housing violations, where a seller chooses one offer over the other one based on, something other than the merits of the offer, whether it's, sex or race or whatever. It opens up the potential for that happening and for the perception of that happening. So as of this year, I'm requesting all of my sellers to allow me to put in the agent notes in the MLS, no buyer love letters. It clutters up the offer process, to be blunt. If you're looking at 8 or 9 or 10 offers, or even one, and you're also dealing with emotional offers or offer letters that saying I'm the best buyer and this is why, it makes it a much more difficult process. Last year, before I started instituting this policy of no buyer love letters, we had 5 or 6 letters in one. It was harder for my sellers to look at the merits when they're considering the emotional components of each buyer in each letter. And I had one last year also that, a listing that the buyers wrote a letter to my sellers, which is, I don't remember what the letter said, but the buyer's cats also wrote a letter to the seller's cats. why those cats should have their owners let them buy the house. It's laughable, but I think it's laughable. But I think it just makes it a more difficult process for everybody, because the perception is the reality. And if you chose an offer because of you like this person better, objectively, you might be choosing for the wrong reason.
I laugh because my wife is a member of one of those and I don't know the proper term of it, but one of those free, F-R-E-E, free items in your local neighborhood thing, you know, oh, I don't use this anymore. Would anybody like it? And somebody else can say, oh, I'm in need of that, or, oh, mine broke. I'd love to have that. And you put it out on your doorstep and somebody comes and claims it. And the rules of that are you can either put your name in and the seller or giver, I guess, in this case, draws numbers because you're not supposed to decide, or you can decide by saying people saying what their reason is for wanting it, and you can do it that way, which is what the whole love letter thing is making me think of. You know, oh, I love pink. I wear pink everywhere. I'd love your unused package of pink socks. I get a laugh at it every time. So, Matt, back to love letters. What have you seen in the mortgage aspect of love letters?
So, unfortunately, I saw a love letter last week on a ratified contract that my client won. I was not aware of the love letter in advance, and I cringed when I saw it attached to the contract. I very much agree with Jim that it's really a fair housing issue. You do not want to come across to say to a seller, I'm just like you. I would fit in really well into this neighborhood. You can read a lot into those comments, and none of them are really good, right? You should be evaluating the merits of the contract placed in front of you. And frankly, sellers have the ability to Google, to go into social media and do research if they wish. Lots of things are out there in the public domain about buyers and sellers. If I were talking to a buyer and they brought this up, I would absolutely discourage them from putting any type of love letter attached to a contract.
Everybody Googles everybody.
Yeah, exactly.
Whether there's a letter or not, the seller, everybody Googles everybody in a transaction. So
there was a cat that I saw on social media this morning. The sellers could not take their cat to their next home. I think it may have been a condo or something like that. So the cat conveyed with the house.
Oh, my.
That's amazing.
The buyers took the cat. They love the cat. Anyway, just thought it was an interesting point.
All right. Local real estate tips. And oddities with Jim Duncan and Matt Hodges. We were talking earlier, Matt, you mentioned, I believe you were the first to mention about some sellers sort of withholding or going slowly about selling a home because of the difficulty or concerns in buying a new one because the homes were selling so quickly. But if someone does want to sell their current home before finding a new one, how do you make this work? There have got to be ways.
There are lots of ways. Not all of them work for all buyers, but I try to explore with the clients that want to do something like this, what are legitimate ways that Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac or Ginnie Mae, one of the people that provide the rules for us, they say is an allowable mechanism. So, for example, you can't take a credit card advance and use that as your down payment because it's not secured to anything. So we discuss things like putting a home equity line of credit against the house that they own. Let's pull the equity out of the house in advance of selling it to use that as a down payment. Let's talk about the bank of mom and dad. As a gift from a parent to a child, you can use that as a down payment, perfectly acceptable. There are ways to access, not liquidate, and by the way, I'm not a financial advisor, so when I throw these options out there, I always include, you should really talk to your financial advisor about these things. But you can extract money in the form of a loan from your 401k. Notice I didn't say liquidate it because I'm not a fan of liquidating stocks or mutual funds for someone's retirement to buy a house. But if there's a mechanism to borrow against it, which will then get repaid when they sell the house, that's a legitimate source for a down payment. So we try to explore with a client who does want to buy that next house first, and they don't have the net proceeds from the sale of the current house. How do you do that? How do you extract money out of the equity, or talk to a family member, or use your employer's 401k? There's quite a number of options that we can look at.
Question that I always wanted to have answered, and we'll start with Jim and then let Matt step in, is, so Jim, I believe you used the number 500,000 earlier. We'll go back to that. I buy a house for $500,000. What is the value of the house a week later after I own it? Does it go up? Does it go down? Does it stay the same? Is it like a car where the car depreciates?
I don't know. I mean, I think it depends. I mean, I think it's something that if you buy the house for $500 today, it could be worth $480 tomorrow, or it could be $515 or $520. It really, really depends. But I think it's something that, again, I look at it through the lens of, if you pay $500 for that house and you are happy there and your family are happy there, then it was worth it. So I think it really depends on what your intentions are. I think it's, on the flip side, you know, it's when a house comes on the market, that first couple of days, you know, if the house comes on at $500, there's no way to tell what that value is, because there are so many buyers out there that if it goes under the contract in the first week, it's probably going to be valued, market value, at $500 or $520, $530, $540, whatever that buyer number nine is willing to pay.
But what if it stays on the market for longer than a week? What if I'm the seller and I put it out there and it's on the market for 2 weeks in today's market?
I won't put a number on it, but I think that the buyers will see that house has been on the market for 2.5 or 3 weeks, and they're asking $500, and the buyer's going to perceive that it's overpriced. You know, because I think that in this market right now, most houses, you know, we'll say most, will go into contract in under 15 days, which is extraordinary from an historical perspective.
Hey, Rick, there's three answers to your question. Let's just pretend I'm an economist and I can give as many answers as I want. The first is, looking back to around 1920, every 10-year increment, you see house appreciation. So the house that you buy today at $500,000, 10 years from now is going to be worth more. Obviously, you got to put an asterisk next to that because you truly don't know. But if history is any guide, it will be worth more. The second answer is, during this velocity time frame that we've talked about of COVID last 2 years, houses have gone up higher than list price and ratified and then sold again later or refinanced again later at a higher value. So how long does a temporary measure like COVID occur? Well, we think it's at its end. We don't think that there's going to be as much of a pandemic. We think it's going to be more of an endemic at this point. And then the third answer is, well, we've already had the appreciation. So what you're buying at right now, figure that if you try to sell the next 2 or 3 years, you're going to take a loss, especially since you need to think about the closing costs, the commissions, et cetera. So those are the three answers. But if you're holding it long term, I think that house at $500,000 is worth more in 10 years.
If I'm buying a home, and Matt, I think I already know the answer to this from you because you touched on it a bit earlier. But if I'm buying a home or trying to buy a home, tell me about an escalation clause, because I want to know if I'm, because there are many people, if you go to an auction, people buy on eBay all the time now, and you put your eyes on something and I'm going to buy it for $100, and then somebody comes in and buys it for $102.50, and you're like, damn it, and suddenly you're buying it for $105, and then somebody buys it, and suddenly you bought it for $145.95, and you're like, oh, damn, I really only wanted to pay $100 for that.
I'll give you the layman's understanding and then defer to Jim, because Jim actually writes these contracts. So a listing comes on, my buyer says, I am willing to bid over it as my starting price, but I know that's only the starting price. I'm also going to write a clause into the contract that says, I'm going to go up by 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, whatever the increment is. I'm going to take steps up, comparing myself to other offers that come in. So my offer's at 500, there's a 505. Well, I've got an escalation that goes over 505. So I've now beaten that borrower, potential buyer, unless they've got an escalation clause. And it plays against one another until the highest and best offer wins the day, because the realtor working with their buyers have both a starting point and an escalation clause where they cap out at. That math should produce the winner. And you should have realtors who are honest, and there are, that do this process appropriately so that the proper person wins the bid at the end of the day.
Well, Jim, do you know any honest realtors? Let's start there, and then you can get into the escalation clause part.
Ha ha. Matt actually answered it really, really well, and I'm going to echo that and then add some different color to it. Yes, if you have a house for 500, one offer goes to 540, and you have another one with the escalation clause that will go to 545. The one for 545 could be the highest and best offer. But I mean, I've got this reasonably complex spreadsheet that I've put together over the years that looks at the other variables in the offer. So if we're looking at 500 starting, 550 is the highest price. Has a loan that they're putting 5% down. And then I've got another one for 540 that is a loan with 20% down. And I might have another one for 537 that has no home inspection. So there are so many variables in there that, yes, the highest price might be the one. But I think that, one, I'll say this, the active realtors that I work with every day, and Matt knows, and Matt works with them also, for the most part, they're awesome and honest people. And their role is just to put out the best offer for their buyers and their sellers that they can do. That
yep,
said,
I agree.
Trust and verify, the clause that many of us use says that not only will, if 500, 545, and 550, if that offer goes into 550, per contract, the ratified price will be $550 so long as the seller produces, I always redact them when I'm a seller, but produces the other offer that forced it up to $550. So it's yes, we trust that it actually went to $550, and we also look at the other offer to verify that it did in fact have a legitimate other bona fide offer. But there are so many variables, Rick, to go into it that, again, if someone could offer 580 with a 5% loan, and someone could offer 540 cash, I might be inclined to advise my buyer to go with that, my seller to go with that 540 cash, because we know that it'll never appraise for anything north of 550 or 530. The escalation clauses are but one piece of making that competitive offer.
And just to follow up, I would think that, well, certainly I'll say Jim Duncan is an honest realtor. And I would think that in today's social media world, there aren't very many sleazy realtors on the market, because word gets around pretty quickly on almost every person who is not very honest with their trade, whether that's real estate or contractors or people at the on the corner selling Girl Scout cookies. So just a few minutes left.
One of the privileges that we have in Charlottesville is that we're a frighteningly small town, and that the realtors, the good ones, we're going to work with each other many, many times over the years, which I think is a real asset and privilege to how I practice. Other markets, like we have an office in Fredericksburg, Nest does, and some of our larger markets, agents might work an entire career and never do a transaction with the same realtor twice, which is an astonishingly foreign concept to me. I've been doing this for 21 years, and I've worked with the same realtor sometimes, 10, 12, 15 times over the years. So I think that for people coming into Charlottesville, I think that one of the assets that we have is that the good ones know the other good ones, and we can practice on a more human level and work things out that I would perceive and assume, often wrongly, but assume that other markets are more pure transactional, and you don't have the opportunity to work things out. So it's something that, for me, is kind of comforting and nice to have a small town like we do. It's really kind of nice.
About 60 seconds left, gentlemen. If I can't find a home, should I go looking for land and build a home?
I'm seeing a lot of clients who are renovating their existing house. I'm seeing clients who are looking at building new, trying to find contractors to start in a reasonable time frame is very difficult right now. It is a process you can go down, but realize you need to invest time.
Really fast. If you contract on a piece of land today, you might be, in your custom build, you might be looking at an 18-month process from contract to close. And at that time, interest rates are likely to go up. Construction costs, labor, everything is going to go up. So you could be contracted for $700 today, and it could be $800 or $850 in 18 months. So, it might be the right thing for the right person, the right solution. But I think it takes the right time and diligence and patience and guts and money.
Wow. Sunday morning wake-up call. Jim Duncan, realtor at Nest Realty, well-recommended. And Matt Hodges, Residential Bank Mortgage. Gentlemen, thank you both for being here very much. Appreciate your time, your efforts, and your work in the community.
Pleasure always.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks, Matt.
All right, folks. We'll see you next week.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.